This is the PC Gamer Podcast for September 12, 2005. This is Episode 3. Our guest today, Sid Meier. Welcome from wherever you are to the official PC Gamer Podcast. We're podcasting from Brisbane, California, home of not too much, but PC Gamer is here. This is Dan Morris, editor-in-chief of PC Gamer, joining us today. DJ Stapleton, our assistant editor.
Ahoy.
From Berkeley, California, our intern Norm Chan.
Hi.
And from Chicago, Illinois, Jeremy Williams, our producer and former editor.
Hello, hello.
And we've got, as usual, some news from around the PC gaming world. We're going to start with a great announcement. The top 100 people who are screwing up America was announced, and the games industry has a man in at number 43. So our congratulations go out to Paul Eibeler, CEO of Take-Two Interactive, publisher of the Grand Theft Auto series. He's now on there with a list of, well, let's see who's here. Michael Moore, Howard Stern, Ted Kennedy, Jesse Jackson, George Soros, Al Franken. It's pretty much the people that you would expect from a right-wing crackpot, basically. But I did want to read the bit from the Indianapolis Star book review that touches on why Paul Eibeler is there. Paul Eibeler is not a household name, but he is the CEO of the company that has netted $2 billion in worldwide sales marketing, the video game Grand Theft Auto, which is chock full of violence, sexual situations, and the murder of virtual cops. His company is currently being sued on behalf of three Alabama men, two of them cops, who were shot and killed by an 18-year-old who had been playing the game nonstop for a solid month. So Paul Eibeler, CEO of a public company, of course, Take-Two, now has a great credit in his resume.
I'd frame it and put it on my wall.
What's the book, and who's the author?
The book is 100 People Who Are Screwing Up America. And the author is Bernard Goldberg.
So somebody you've probably never heard of.
He is an 8-time Emmy Award-winning former CBS correspondent.
Wow. Okay, maybe you have heard of him.
If you watch CBS. DJ, you said that this guy was actually interviewed on The Daily Show recently.
He was on The Daily Show, and he was. You don't usually see Jon Stewart go after somebody like that, but he kind of shredded him on there. He's usually very courteous to the guests, but not so much with this guy.
Yeah, my question is, how do I get on to the next edition of this book?
You keep on this podcast long enough, and you might.
Oh, excellent.
It's kind of a bad news week for games in general in that regard. I mean, we had some news related to this front. Which was that Assemblyman Leland Yee, who, by the way, I'm a constituent of, I get the privilege of voting against this guy as soon as possible. He finally had some legislation passed in the Assembly here in California, and basically what it does is it now fines video game retailers like GameStop and EB or whoever if they sell an M-rated game to a minor. Now you won't get the same kind of fine if you're a movie theater and you sell an R-rated movie ticket to a kid,
or NC-17,
or NC-17 for that matter. You can go ahead and sell American Psycho to a kid if you work at Barnes and Noble. That's fine too. But as of now, this bill being passed, if it's signed by the governor, you'll be fined for selling Grand Theft Auto to a 16-year-old.
And their argument is that it's an interactive medium, so it's that much more harmful to kids. So if you know, American Psycho or one of those another mindlessly violent book is Choose Your Own Adventure, then you should have a problem with that too.
Well, sure, because then it's an interactive medium.
I was under the impression that movie theaters would be in trouble of some sort if they let minors into NC-17 movies or R-rated movies without parents.
And you'd be wrong. In the state of California, there's no legislation about that.
Oh, so it's sort of a state-by-state thing?
Yeah, well, every state gets to make its own rules.
Gotcha.
And now California has a rule about this and not about any other entertainment medium.
Well, that's not fair. I hate to be the lone dissenter on this. I'm actually in favor of that kind of legislation. I just think it should exist for movies, too.
That's the annoying thing about it is I don't think you're going to find anyone who's going to say that this legislation is necessarily wrong-headed. Although, of course, you know, I traded emails with Leland Yee this week, and the reasons why he wants this legislation enacted are completely absurd. I mean, basically, what DJ said is right. He is a child psychologist. He has a doctorate. He's trained. And his feeling is that there are studies out there that have convinced him that the games medium itself, with its interactivity, is rewiring the brain in essence. It's desensitizing people to real-world violence and making them more aggressive. Now, what I told Assemblyman Yi is that, as he can read in the new issue of PC Gamer, we have an article that basically looks at all of the evidence from justice statistics since the country has been keeping them. The FBI's Bureau of Justice Statistics will show you that since 1993, there's been a precipitous drop in the actual amount of youth crime, violent crime committed by and against youth in America. And I asked him how he can square this precipitous decline with the parallel explosion in video game play.
Yeah.
And he didn't even bother. He just said, what counts here is that there's all kinds of let me not paraphrase him. I'm going to let him speak for himself. I'm going to pull up the email right now. Assemblyman Yi says, I understand the harmful effects these games have on our children. I also understand how statistics can be manipulated. I assume now he's talking about the FBI's statistics. I rely on our parents, teachers, psychiatrists, and pediatricians who say we need this bill to protect our children. Also, greater aggression does not necessarily translate into violent crime, but sometimes less violent crime or poorer performance in school. So I guess he's worried that Grand Theft Auto is going to be responsible for a spate of pigtail pulling or cheating on an algebra test. I mean, it's hard to say. He's really got a wide open definition there.
Cue Helen Lovejoy screaming, "Won't somebody please think of the children?
Won't somebody please think of the children?" The other question that I asked Assemblyman Yi was why he never talks about the large body of studies, including the U.S. Surgeon General, the governments of Australia and Denmark, the Washington State Health Board, and many others, which have concluded that it's impossible to correlate video game violence with real-world violence. And his answer to that was that many respected medical organizations around the world have concluded that children who play ultraviolent video games are more likely to view violence as an effective way of settling conflicts, and that such children have a higher tendency for violent and aggressive behavior later in life, making me ask again, why have we seen... But when I say precipitous drop in crime, I mean it. I mean, in 1993... For every 1,000 members of the population, there were approximately 50 incidents of violent crime.
Well, among youths.
Now it's 20. It's 20 as of 2003, the last year for which statistics are available. That's a cut of more than half. That's 1993 to 2003, which of course is a decade where, I mean, that was the PlayStation decade. That was the decade where video game play exploded.
So, it really does lend some weight to the argument that playing these games lets off steam. Rather than promoting violent behavior, it gives you kind of a release valve.
Well, who knows? I mean, I don't know if we can say that either, but what we can say for sure is that we have never had a less violent generation of American youngsters than the one we have right now and since 1993.
You know, this argument has been beaten to death. I don't want to get too deep into it, but my beef has always been that people who don't play games watch these things and they see violent behavior on the screen. But the people who play the games don't see the violence, they just see the gameplay. There's a game mechanic involved that people who are watch over the shoulder don't get.
I'll tell you, one thing is for sure. I mean, I've been a hardcore gamer all my life, big fan of the GTA series, and it really has increased my desire to slap politicians. It's really physiologically changed me in that regard. Moving right along.
Addition to that. Within the next week or so, there should be a re-release of Grand Theft Auto San Andreas after it was pulled off the shelves for the hot coffee fiasco. Though it's still unclear whether some retailers like Walmart will carry it even after they knock the rating down to M.
Has Walmart said it might not?
They haven't said anything either way, but there's speculation. So
they're basically going to be confirming this game is now an M rating. It's safe for your 17 or 18 year olds to play.
Yeah.
Because there's no sex in it. I mean, you can still beat people to death with dildos. So that's fine. It'll still have the M rating, but there's no nudity, so we're all squared away.
Yeah. But Walmart, being as moral as they are, may or may not decide to carry it.
It's worth pointing out there was never nudity.
There was nudity. Hot Coffee, there was nudity.
There was no nudity.
But there was.
You're absolutely wrong, Jeremy. There was nudity. What there wasn't was any hardcore representation of of a sexual act.
There was no nudity. You had to install a separate patch to get nudity.
Well, that's what Hot Coffee is.
That's what we're talking about.
But there was the original Hot Coffee mod, which unlocked the content that was in the game. And in the official Rockstar textures, there's no actual nudity. The breasts are covered up with cut-off T-shirts and lingerie, and of course, there's no genitals.
Oh, really? So the later Hot Coffee mod added those textures?
Yes.
You're going to need to send me a link to that, because that is not only is that not the information I have, but that's not the information that anyone has. No one has reported that.
Oh, no, I've seen that actually reported. And I've actually installed the mod. So
you found out firsthand.
Yeah.
Is it hot?
It's incredibly lukewarm.
My understanding was don't even bother, cuz there's nothing there you can't see like on TV after 10 p.m. The World Cyber Games Finals were just held, and as normal, tell us, I guess the losers had to do some push-ups?
Well, it's the U.S. Finals were just held. The World Finals are going to be held in Singapore this year, but the U.S. winners were just announced. Team 3D won both in the Halo 2 division and the Counter-Strike division. They're last year's champions. Losers had to go do some push-ups. They did have a separate competition, and surprisingly, the most that any one of them could do was 40.
Well, I'm surprised they could do 40. I don't think anyone on this staff could do 40.
That's actually a fairly impressive number of push-ups for a game.
So is Team USA headed to Singapore for the World Final?
They are headed
to
Singapore. The World Cyber Games.
Or Team 3D, I should say.
Yeah, a bunch of them and other members of the U.S. team. It's going to be, they're trying to make it like an Olympic event. They'll have representatives from every country. They even have like a big anthem that you can download online. I'll post that up on the website later on. But talking to that, Singapore, which is this year's host for the World Cyber Games, recently announced that they're allowing one of their citizens to defer their mandatory 2 years required military service so he can compete in the World Cyber Games. And for a country that spends almost 30% of their government expenditures on the military and has this huge military commitment for all its citizens, I mean, it's kind of weird that they would let one of their guys.
That really tells you something about gaming in Singapore. I mean, in the United States, in the Vietnam War, they wouldn't let Muhammad Ali defer. They packed him up and sent him to the army. And this was the world heavyweight champion of boxing.
Though, to be fair, that was a time of war.
Well, fair enough. But
I don't think Singapore is actively fighting anybody.
So who's the favorite over there, Norm?
Who's the favorite?
Yeah, who's going to win that thing? Does America have a chance?
It's always the Swedes. Swedes win it all in Counter-Strike every year. Yeah. Last year, U.S. won. It's a big uproar. We are the defending champions for Counter-Strike, the biggest game in the tournament, but who knows?
When will we know? When are they playing it?
Not actually sure. It's going to be later this year. It'll be later this November.
All right. Well, Team 3D, if you're listening, go get them. We're going to be joined in just a bit by Sid Meier. He's I don't know if he's the head of Firaxis Games. They may have a president, but he's certainly the spiritual head of Firaxis Games, one of the most celebrated game designers in history and a veritable PC gamer game god. Civilization IV is going gold this very week, and he's been kind enough to agree to talk to us a little bit about the series and what he's working on for the post-Civ future, so we'll be getting to him in just a bit.
Hi, I'm Sid Meier, and you're listening to the PC Gamer Podcast.
All right, we're joined by Sid Meier from Firaxis out of Maryland. Welcome, Sid.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Civ 4 is coming out to an audience that has been waiting for it for a long time. We've had readers who have been playing Civilization literally since they were 8 years old. For me, I think it was since I was about 12. There's definitely a lot of goodwill for the series and a lot of high expectations. I'm just hoping to ask you in general, what were you guys thinking about when it came time to create a Civ 4 and push the series forward? And what was the overall design ethic you guys had in mind as you sat down to go into the fray once more with the Civ series?
Well, I think the challenge with Civilization is always to kind of meet the expectations of our of our fans, of our experienced players, but also make it a game that's appealing to new players. And I think with Civ 4, we've had some great technical opportunities. The ability to use 3D for the first time in a Civilization game kind of really brings the world to life. You can watch everything happening, the units moving, the animals, the terrain, the cities are all kind of alive, and it's a new look for Civilization. And there's also a new interface, I think, that really will streamline the game and make it more appealing to first-time players, using a lot of real-time strategy conventions and putting really all the important information on the screen very accessible. So it's always fun to kind of revisit Civilization, reimagine it. We're able to kind of incorporate a lot of ideas that our fans have sent to us, our players, a very active community with lots of great ideas. Also some new ideas that we've had, and kind of stir it all together and come up with a new Civilization.
What are some ideas that the fans have provided that made it into the game?
Well, I think one thing that the fans have been asking for a long time is multiplayer, is true multiplayer. Civilization as a turn-based game works very well, single player. But it's always been a challenge to come up with a way of playing multiplayer with, you know, 6, 8, 10 other people that keeps the game moving forward, keeps the pacing, and keeps it exciting. And for this iteration of Civ, we designed multiplayer in from the beginning. There are lots of shorter scenarios if you want to play it for a fairly short time. There's simultaneous movement. There's a lot of things to do in the game, and a lot of ways to team up with other players to cooperate as well as compete. So I think people will find the multiplayer in this is a lot more satisfying and a really essential part of the game, standing right next to the single-player experience.
I'm curious about what you mentioned. You mentioned RTS conventions. I mean, probably the one phrase that's most associated with the Civ series is one more turn. it's just such a turn-based phenomenon. I'm curious about what you guys had in mind when you sat in to put some RTS conventions into the game.
Well, that's a good question. Our game is still proudly turn-based. We believe for a game with this kind of strategy, with this kind of depth to it, that you need to have the game move at your pace. If you want to take some time to think about what you're going to do next, the game lets you do that. There's a lot of depth to this, a lot of the decisions that you make, so a turn-based game really allows the player to kind of absorb everything and really feel that they're in control of the game. But there are lots of ideas from real-time strategy, you know, mouse overs for giving you information on units, on map things, the idea of progress bars to kind of indicate exactly how far you are towards developing that next technology or building that next building or creating that next wonder of the world. So a lot of the kind of interface, the way the information is presented is in a kind of a simple, common, universal way that people who played just about any other strategy game before will be able to understand. So it's a way of kind of making the game, again, more accessible to a person who might not have played a previous Civilization game.
A lot of people understand that you're not the hands-on day-to-day designer on Civ 4, but they're curious to know what you are doing. You probably can't talk about specific projects, but I just would like to know what is your day-to-day design activities. I mean, I've been told that there's basically a little Sid Meier think tank of a few people who are sort of sitting around in Santa's workshop designing the next big strategy game. I'm just curious to know, what is that process like? What do you do day-to-day in terms of the design lab over there?
Sure. I love designing games and writing games and making games, so and I'm very fortunate to be able to do that here at Firaxis. For me, the most fun part is kind of the initial stage, the first couple months where you have a brand new idea and you start to throw something up on the screen and see what happens. So that's kind of in the mode that I'm in right now, spending a little time on Civ 4, playing it and whatever suggestions I have, feeding them into the pipeline, but also looking for kind of our next generation of games. And I use the word next generation specifically. I think working with Take-Two, our publisher, you know, they're a very strong force in the console world, and we're gradually moving in that direction from our PC roots. So we're looking at both PC and console opportunities going forward, and it's part of the challenge, I think, is to kind of take some of our our game ideas, our approach to gaming, and bring it to life on the new console platform. So,
and I assume that you are planning new IP for one or both consoles.
Yes, we like to combine kind of our known IPs with some new ideas. Not alternating, but about 50-50. So some of the ideas we are working on are brand new. Some of them are based on things we've done before. It's been very gratifying, not only with Civilization, but recently with Pirates, to see how an idea that that we first introduced 10 or 15 years ago still has a lot of life and vitality to it these days. And I think we've always believed that gameplay is the most important thing, and kind of good game ideas are timeless. And I think Civilization and Pirates have kind of indicated that there might be something to that.
Hi, Sid. This is DJ. There are a few features in Civ 4 that I'm pretty excited about, and these are the big ones. I know they had to run by you before you gave the thumbs up. The religion feature is something
right.
That's been really missing from the last Civ games.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as big a role as it's played in the history of the world.
Right.
I'm just wondering, how did you manage to do that without pissing everybody off? Because it seems like it'd be really easy to do by mistake. So.
Right, you certainly have to be careful there. I think what's really happened over time is that the original game, although we called it Civilization, was essentially a military game, and people said, hey, you've got this game and you call it Civilization, but it's really all about war and military units and capturing the world and conquering the world. And our response was, right. Well, that's the most fun thing to do, But I think over time, with the successive iterations, we've introduced other paths to victory, other ways to win, other strategies and other approaches that involve culture and diplomacy and technology and things like that. And religion is another system that we've introduced to kind of give you, again, one more way to play the game, one more path to go down, another element to introduce into your strategy. So, a great Civ experience is kind of mixing all these things together, military, economic, diplomatic, the religion system, the culture system, and you kind of are always balancing things off when you make decisions, and that's kind of what makes the game fun and interesting to play. And it also really introduces this idea of, okay, next time I play, I'm going to try this strategy, and you kind of always looking forward to maybe trying something a little different the next time. So, the Civ experience kind of goes on and on. There's not only is there one more turn, but there's one more game. I've got to play another game to try this other strategy. So it's the kind of game that almost never runs out of interesting things to do.
Right. So it's just one more layer of replayability.
Right. It's another layer of replayability. It's an alternative strategy. There's some new ideas. It's something we call a culture bomb, where you kind of plant a city next to an enemy city. If you have a superior culture, folks in the other player city will decide to join you because your culture is so cool. They want to be part of your civilization. So you can conquer the world not only militarily, but with your advanced culture.
And as far as the new interface, do you think that will turn off some of the hardcore fans, or is it something you can jump right into and not feel like it's been dumbed down at all?
Oh, it's definitely not dumbed down. I think that it's actually allowed us to introduce some new features. I mean, I think one of the issues with Civilization is overwhelming the player with different kind of obscure details. I think by streamlining the interface, by making the information more accessible, we can add new things and not make the game unplayable. That's always something that we're concerned about, is that the topic, the subject matter is so rich that if we tossed into the game everything we possibly could, it would just be overwhelming and unplayable. So
right.
we're streamlining not only the interface but also the ideas that go into the game. We want to pick the key military technologies, the key leaders, the key most interesting parts of Civilization, and build the game around that.
Did you, as far as interface goes, did you learn any lessons from seeing Massive Orion 3 just kind of flop? Because that one was really cluttered. I couldn't even get 10 minutes into a game without being frustrated by the interface.
I have to admit, I didn't play Masters of Orion 3.
You didn't miss anything.
I think the idea of a space conquest game is a great one, but I saw There is a
little space conquest game called Alpha Centauri out there. It was funny for me to see that when we had a comments thread inviting people to submit some questions for this podcast, we actually had several all basically saying, what do you have against Alpha Centauri 2? You know, huge fans of Alpha Centauri who were wondering when you might be going back to that universe.
Well, it's certainly a possibility. A great game, you know, really interesting take on the whole civilization approach to things, but, you know, an exciting new world to put it in, and I think that was a really fun combination. We have, unfortunately, a lot of ideas and a limited amount of time and people to make games, so we're trying to make the ones that we think will be the most fun for people. But Alpha Centauri is certainly a game that we're very proud of and may be able to revisit sometime in the future.
I had a very strange moment recently. I was reading a book of essays about, of all things, technological doomsday scenarios. And in one of the essays, they were talking about this thing called the technological singularity, which is this philosophical idea about how at a certain point in the near future, technology is going to become so advanced that it's going to make human life basically unimaginable from our current perspective. And they used as an example Alpha Centauri. They said toward the end of Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri, an event much like the technological singularity occurs. And I thought, wow, this is it. I mean, Sid Meier has actually arrived in the world of academic futurism. It was a pretty insane moment.
Well, we've actually had a lot of contact with the academics. I mean, they'll find something in our game, especially like Civilization, that kind of reinforces or proves a point, obscure point of theirs that they've been working on for a long time. And I think we got a call from someone on Wall Street marveling at how Civilization explained tax policy, in a very succinct and clear way. Or the military, or different groups, and it's also been used in educationally quite a bit. You know, it's a fun game to play, but it also takes you through thousands of years of history and introduces you to the great leaders, the great technologies, the great ideas of time. So, and it's got a lot of interesting uses. We try and make it a fun game first, but. By kind of linking into a lot of things that people are familiar with or kind of want to learn about or think are interesting, that creates all sorts of possibilities.
We got a great question submitted from a reader about Civ 4. I want to summarize it to you. It comes from a fellow in Turkey. It says, in the new Civ 4, I realized that out of 18 civilizations, Turks are not one of them. This is absolutely ridiculous. We are the only people who founded 16 states and 4 empires. Nearly made Europe fall to her knees. There are 150 million Turks throughout the world, and yet Mali is in the game, and we're not. This is a tragedy. I accept that all kinds of cultures have done all kinds of great things, but we conquered the whole of Asia Minor. And at our highest extent, the empire extended from the Caucasus to Morocco. So now's your chance. Defend to this young man why Turkey is not one of the empires in Civ 4.
Well, it's always amazing how people take the games personally and seriously. I mean, I guess that's a tribute to how much time they spend with them and how much they get into them. But we certainly are unfortunately not able to put every civilization and every great country and every great civilization into our games. It might be a good time to mention the modding feature of Civilization. It's one of the things that, starting with Civ 2 and Civ 3 and now Civ 4, have become really key features of the game. The ability for players to change the rules, change many aspects of the game to kind of make it fit what they think their view of civilization or something, a way of playing that they might think is more fun, and then share those ideas and mods and changes with other players. So we've seen a very vibrant mod community for the Civilization games, where you can download new scenarios, new maps, new units, new rules, all sorts of things that are created by players. So perhaps this young man would want to create a Turkey Conquers the World scenario and share it with the rest of the Civ players.
So how soon after the release of the game do you expect we'll see mods start to trickle out? Have you sent out early copies to people that have made mods in the past that want to make mods for Civ 4?
We have our internal folks making scenarios and for the game, and we'll release those tools to the modding community. At the moment, we're pretty intensely working on finishing up the game, so it's not something that we can put a lot of energy into. But once the game is shipped, that'll become a key thing, I think, in extending the life of it and extending the interest of it, and is really encouraging the mod community. So that should start happening fairly soon.
Are you planning on regularly releasing new scenarios and mods from the development team after the game comes out?
We've already planned some expansions and some new things over the next year or so. I think that's something that we've done in the past and has really been well received by the community. So we definitely plan to support the game and keep some things coming out for it, as well as encouraging our players to do that.
Okay, I'd like to wrap up with a question that really puts people on the spot, I've noticed. what's a question about the Civ series that you always thought should have been asked and just never was? And, of course, what's the answer?
What about massively multiplayer civilization? Wouldn't a game of this size and scope and variety lend itself to massively multiplayerness? That's an interesting question. It's a tough... I think it was a challenge to make the game multiplayer, and it would be an even larger but very interesting challenge to make it massively multiplayer. I hate to do this, but I almost encourage our players to think about how Civ would make an interesting massively multiplayer game. Certainly, that direction is something we're seeing more and more of, the whole idea of massively multiplayer. And although many of the current games kind of follow a certain mold, I think that maybe breaking that mold with an idea like Civilization would be very interesting. So we'll kind of toss that out there as something to think about for the future.
World is Civilization. We'll look forward to it.
Can I play as the orcs?
No orcs.
Thanks very much for joining us, Sid. We sure appreciate the time.
It's been fun. Thank you.
So what are we playing this week? I noticed that Dungeon Siege 2, we had Chris Taylor on for episode 1, and it's right up there in the sales. It's number 2 behind World of Warcraft, which has been number 1 since it launched. So congratulations go out there to everyone at Gas Powered. I know Jeremy was trying out some something exotic.
Yeah, for the PC gamers out there, probably. The Sony PSP actually has me intrigued this week. And not so much for the games that are out right now, which all... are, kind of first generation...
Lumines.
Yes. Well, actually, Lumines is probably the best one out there, but I'm still sort of tired of
everyone, that. Everyone here who went out and bought the PSP has not touched it in months.
Well, here's a reason to touch it. I actually installed a bunch of homebrew software, which is really, really cool. There are emulators for just about every 1980s and early 90s console under the sun. But something of particular interest for PC gamers is there's a really, really good Scum emulator. Scum being the engine that LucasArts used for their adventure games in the late 80s, early 90s, like Sam & Max, Day of the Tentacle, the Indiana Jones series. And these games aren't really being emulated. It's not like the... PSP's emulating a PC or anything. It's actually playing these games natively. They've rewritten the Scum engine from scratch so it'll run on the PSP. And you use the analog stick to move the mouse, point and click, and it plays these games at the full frame rate. And as long as you have the data files from your floppies, you just copy them right over. And they play great, voice and sound, and it works. Very, very cool. There's also an Amiga emulator, which I'm sure a lot of PC gamers out there had in the 80s. It's an A500 emulator. You can play the old Amiga games and demos and stuff.
How illegal is that process?
Scum actually has been approved by LucasArts. LucasArts has said to the Scum team, do what you want. They're really? They're really cool about it because the emulator has no copyrighted data in it. It's just an emulator for the data files so that they can run LucasArts games on any platform. So you still have to have the data files.
Plus, yeah, Sony doesn't really like you to.
You don't upgrade your PSP, right?
Well, exactly right. No, no. If you want to do this, you cannot upgrade to the new firmware, which, if I'm telling you now, you've probably already done, and there's no way to downgrade yet. There's supposedly a group working on a downgrader so you can bring your PSP from 2.0 firmware back down to 1.5.
Right, so it's a trade-off between internet on your PSP
right.
or scum.
Because they added a really nice web browser with this 2.0 firmware built into the PSP, and that allows you to do some really cool stuff like browsing the web from wherever you are or access your iTunes music collection using a web browser plugin and stuff like that. But, yeah, it's sort of a trade-off because if you want to play this homebrew stuff, you can't install it. You have to stick with 1.5 firmware.
Nothing
so
like
Norm, what have you been playing?
Battlefield 2.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
What rank are you up to now?
Corporal. Corporal. A little bit of Battlefield 2 news. There was a bit of patch news leaked on some message boards that says that they'll scale down the points needed to reach up the next rank. So hopefully when that comes out in the next couple of weeks.
Wait, first things first. So is that the patch with a capital P that we've all been waiting for?
Yes. It addresses a lot of issues that I've been concerned about and other players have been concerned about.
Please tell me they're fixing the server browser.
Please.
They're going to add stuff to that. They're going to make it much faster. You're not going to get killed by vehicles as easily, so you won't just, you know, step next to a tank and get team killed.
Good, because I run over myself in boats a lot. Getting out, boat runs over me, I'm dead.
Yeah. Ranks and awards will be changed, so it'll take less points to get awards. And one thing I'm actually, I'm not sure if it's actually going to make it to the patch, but in the leaked notes it says that if you're in a vehicle and you want to capture a flag, you have to get out of the vehicle now if you're not the driver.
Wow,
to
interesting.
Help the control point capture.
That which makes sense. I like that change.
That takes care of that whole helicopter flying around the map, taking all the flags instantly. Because you get a fully loaded Blackhawk, you hover over a flag, it's yours in 2 seconds, and then you fly on to the next one.
Oh, wow. You don't even have to land?
Oh, man, no. It's so annoying. When you find an enemy who can do that, they'll just pack a chopper. They'll just fly flag to flag, and if you can't bring that chopper down, I've seen games end in about 4 minutes.
Yeah,
the round is over.
They pack the chopper with engineers that can repair it as you're... Yeah, I've put like eight rockets into it and can't bring it down.
Yeah. It's the opposite of fun.
Did you mention that, Norm, that also adjusting how quickly an engineer can repair a helicopter?
That's right, yeah. It'll be a lot slower now for an engineer to repair them.
Very good. Because those things are just death.
And so when is that patch?
Nobody knows.
It's a projected October release date, early October.
Oh, no. There's that projection again.
Yep.
Which so means December.
We project, we'll get around to it sometime.
Yeah.
Well, it can't come fast enough. I'm still having a blast with it, though, but I'd love to see it show up. We got AOE going goal pretty soon. I'm told we'll be playing that before the end of the week.
Yeah, the demo of that just came out, and there was some mixed reviews online.
I don't know how there could be mixed reviews about that. I mean, every time I see that game, it just looks... JT was saying the same thing. We had our intern JT playing hands-on.
Yeah, I played a little bit of the demo.
He was less than blown away.
I played a little bit of the demo, and the first, biggest concern for me is that the interface is huge. I mean, even at high resolution, the interface takes up a third of the screen. And, you can't zoom out far enough to see, a whole lot of stuff. And when the interface is taking up a third of the screen, that's kind of limiting for me. So that's my biggest concern. The other thing for me is that it looks a lot like AOE 2, I mean, except in 3D. It doesn't look as good as I thought it would.
Really? I would say the only thing I was going to say is from a reader's perspective, the graphics look amazing. This looks to me like they really...
Screenshots they posted online do look really great. A lot of it comes from the new city feature, where you build your home city. And I think a lot of people are still adjusting to that.
The home city, though, is not actually... You don't actually build that. You push a button and you go to the home city and you can buy upgrades and shipments of resources, but that's not actually, and it's like a menu. It's not the actual game itself.
So we got a couple of questions via MP3. The address, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jeremy, is pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com.
Exactly.
You're free to send us MP3 questions. We actually got a couple prior to this broadcast, so we're going to give you your day in court. Hang on one second.
Hello, gang. This is Jim from St. Louis. I've been enjoying your podcasts. I'm a big fan of MMOs. Are there any upcoming ones that you're especially looking forward to? And have you ever tried EVE Online? What's your opinion of that MMO?
There's a terrific story that I have to tell about EVE Online. It's a game that I haven't tried out, but the people that I know who are playing it just love it. I mean, they love it to death, and in Europe, it's huge. And the story was... all right, now the basic setup for EVE, for those who don't know it, it's corporations fighting each other in a distant science fiction far future. Now, they allow you to do pretty much whatever you want, and this nefarious, shadowy cartel of assassins got it in their heads to create a heist. They joined this large, well-known corporation, which is basically the equivalent of a guild, and spent weeks and weeks befriending the members of the group, rising to positions of prominence in the corporation. One of them became a personal aide to the corporation leader. And then at a predetermined date, Pearl Harbor style, they all turned on their new corporation. The aide murdered the CEO. Everyone in the position of power started pilfering money, siphoning all their credits away, stealing all the ships that they'd spent months, if not years, assembling, robbed them blind, and then basically posted a post jackalizing them on the official EVE Online message board. To give you some scale of the heist, I don't have the exact figure in front of me. I wish I did, but it was material that they stole was worth thousands of dollars, real-world dollars, if you were selling that stuff on the open market. They basically robbed these guys for a high four figures payday. I think any MMO that allows you to do that is okay by me.
Yeah.
Sounds like they were pretty well organized about it too.
Oh, it was a completely well organized screw job. It was brilliant.
They put a lot of work into it. They earned that money.
So I mean, I hear
when
some
Lord Garrett was killed back in a.
It does kind of harken to the classic assassination of Lord British.
Are there any MMOs that you guys are looking forward to?
D&D Online for me.
Yeah. City of Villains is coming out. I'm a little bit worried that it's going to be too much, you know, kind of more of the same of City of Heroes. But it could still be fun.
Yeah, and Blizzard is announcing the expansion to World of Warcraft, which is by far the biggest MMO right now, at BlizzCon. So I'll be looking forward to that.
Hey, this is Keenan Weaver from Grizzled Iowa, Vagabond from the PC Gamer forums. And I was wondering what your favorite PC game soundtracks are.
That's a good question.
I think mine, Total Annihilation, is the obvious choice. I also really liked Homeworld, the original Homeworld.
Oh, you're absolutely right, dude. I forgot about that. That's a fantastic soundtrack. But that kind of orchestral soundtrack?
Yeah, it was done by the band Yes.
Well, that,
yeah,
they,
that's right.
Was the whole thing done by Yes? Because I know that they had that one sort of pop song for the credits done by Yes.
I'm pretty sure Yes did not do the orchestral soundtrack for Homeworld.
No?
Go to Moby Games, find out.
Yeah, but that soundtrack was awesome. That totally got me hooked, and I that's the only RTS that I've ever played start to finish.
I would say that the consensus answer to that question is it's the soundtrack that Jeremy Soule did for Total Annihilation. And what's kind of interesting about that is that they're going back to the well when Gas-Powered Games makes Supreme Commander. They're going to have Jeremy Soule on board to do a soundtrack for that.
Wow.
You know, soundtracks in terms of music is one thing, but I think that sound effects also kind of goes on underappreciated in the industry, and something that you take for granted but actually adds a ton to the experience.
It goes unappreciated among us editor types, but I'll tell you, anytime I go to a developer, that's what they're spending half their time on.
With the sound?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're going out of their way to hire people who have won Oscars and Emmys in sound design for movies and TV because they know exactly how important that is.
Well, there's a difference between soundtrack and score, and a lot of games don't actually have soundtracks, but one of my favorite ones is actually the Duke Nukem soundtrack. It was a separate CD that you bought called Music to Score By, the official Duke Nukem album, and it had songs by Slayer and Megadeth, and you could buy it, and you know the idea was to play it in the background while you played Duke Nukem.
Yeah. Okay, just to follow up on the Homeworld thing, Looking at Wikipedia's page, because Moby did not have it, says, with the exception of a song by the rock group Yes, entitled The Ladder, most of the music in the game's ambience matching the lonely but beautiful environment of Deep Space. Also worthy of note is the inclusion of Samuel Barber's Angus D, the choral version of his Adigo for Strings.
Oh, who could forget Angus D?
Good old Angus.
I gotta give props to Omicron the Nomad Soul, if you guys remember that.
Sure, that was David Bowie, wasn't it?
Yeah, David Bowie worked with the game developers, and he played digital concerts in the game from as a CD.
Yeah, you could pull up and just listen to a new Bowie concert in the game.
Yeah, yeah, and you watch.
Nothing wrong
game.
With that. As opposed to Star Wars Galaxies, where you can see the Cantina guys playing.
Can you be a Cantina guy in Star Wars Galaxies?
Oh yeah, well. Yeah,
you'd be surprised how many people are.
There's a whole entertainment profession.
You know that little squiggly guy who sits at the keyboard just kind of jamming?
Yeah.
There's a guy who's been doing that for 2 years. And all he's asking for is a tip every now and then.
Nice.
That's PC gaming for you. It's a wide open frontier. All right, well, that should just about wrap us up for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Again, an invitation to send us questions via MP3, PCGamerPodcast@gmail.com is the place to send that. Or you can just go to PCGamerPodcast.com and leave a question for us in any of the message threads. There's one for each show. And for Jeremy Williams out in Chicago, for Norm Chan out in Berkeley, for Dan Stapleton about 4 feet away from me, and for myself, Dan Morris, editor-in-chief at PC Gamer, thanks for listening, and we'll tune in next week. Check the website to see who our guests will be, and leave questions for them. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Just a regular chicken kiss of the year, please. Thank you. Oh, lunch. Thank God.